9. The tunnel did not descend in a straight line. Tam didn't expect it to. It was something of the Yuuzhan Vong, and they never did anything in straight lines. But that, and the fact that it had been bored through Duracrete, meant that Tam could clamber down rather than drop to a messy bone-breaking stop at the bottom. Another scream floated up at him, louder. A few meters down, the Duracrete gave way to bedrock, then became Duracrete again. It looked as though there were sub-basements below, levels that perhaps were not accessed by the public turbolifts and emergency stairwells, and the Yuuzhan Vong intruder had found them. Tam could see, even dig his fingers into, smaller side holes in this tunnel. He supposed that whatever stone-eating organisms had made the tunnels, at first dug around in all directions, and then conveyed images or other knowledge to the Yuuzhan Vong spy who commanded them, allowing him or her to choose which path the main tunnel would follow. He found a larger niche, 2 meters deep and one high. Its bottom was lined with some sort of mossy substance. He'd seen it before, one type of sleep surface. There were also gelatin-like bags he knew to contain bioengineered creatures that performed various functions when released from the jelly. He'd possessed some of them when he served the Yuuzhan Vong. There was another scream, and the sound of voices speaking. He slowed his descent, tried to make it quieter. A few more meters, and the hole opened up into a chamber. Lights flickered red and blue down there, suggesting a computer terminal screen rather than overhead illumination. And finally, Tam could understand one of the voices. It was a male, and he spoke basic, with the halting accent and peculiar rhythm he'd come to associate with the member of the Yuuzhan Vong trying not to reveal his true origins. "Where is the true crystal?" he asked. There was no immediate response. Then there was another shriek. The next speaker also sounded male, though his words were distorted by pain. "It's gone. It's been taken to the pipe fighter already." "The pipe fighter abominations are still in the flat building. They have not fired upon us. They leave the lambent in that building when guards are more numerous here." "Yes, yes." There was another scream. This one went on and on, ending only as the second speaker ran out of wind. Tam grimaced. He had to see what was going on in that chamber before he could act. But although he could wait here at the tunnel end, his legs braced at the side, for some time, he couldn't turn upside down to peek outside it. He wasn't that nimble. Ah, but he had another set of eyes. Hurriedly, he took his light-duty holocam from around his neck. He detached its neck cord, attached it so that the unit could dangle. Its lenses pointed to the side, and its quick-review view screen oriented up toward him. He adjusted the lenses to wide-angle viewing, then lowered the unit to the very bottom of the tunnel and slightly beyond. In the view screen, he could see the chamber below. It appeared that the tunnel was in the ceiling of one corner. The chamber itself was mostly lined with computer equipment, but in one corner was a doorway that probably led to a hallway or stairs, and in the opposite corner was a sort of stall. This was about the same size as a refresher's shower, and like a shower, was bounded by transparent walls. In the bottom of the stall was a mound of what looked like broken transparisteel shards. Next to the stall was a chair. In it sat a Bothan male, bound hand, arm, and foot. Leaning over him was a human male in a mechanic's jumpsuit. Tam thought for a moment that the Bothan was diseased. There were irregular bumps on his face, on his fur, wherever his garments did not cover it. Then he realized that the bumps were moving, writhing, bugs of some sort. As Tam watched, the mechanic brought his hand to the Bothan's forehead. There was an audible crunching noise, and the Bothan screamed again. When the mechanic lowered his hand, the Bothan's forehead had one more wiggling bump on it. "Woolum, where are you?" But Tam realized that he could neither wait for Woolum to finish persuading the security forces to come, nor speed that process along. The Bothan might die, a death that truly would be on Tam's conscience. But what could he do? He took stock of his possessions. One hand-sized holocam, various data cards, a comlink, a small vibroblade he'd always carried because it made him feel better, not because he knew how to use it well, and his brain, a brain that didn't always work in an admirably efficient fashion. He left the vibroblade switched off and put it between his teeth. He had other tools. The chamber below was dark, lit only by terminal screens. Screams would cover small noises. And he was a strong man, though no fighter. He had size and muscle mass that fighters had often admired. On the ledge where the moss grew, he set the holocam. He advanced it through its recording memory until he reached one recently recorded scene, then set it to play back on a 60-standard-second timer. He waited until he heard another question, answer, and scream. As the scream began, he lowered himself into the chamber below. Now, all the mechanic, a Yuuzhan Vong operative, it was obvious, possibly a warrior, had to do was turn his head to see Tam. One look, one attack, and Tam would be dead. But the mechanic didn't turn. He leaned in close to witness the Bothan's agonies. Tam, at arm's extension, let go with one hand and swung, but the extra reach brought his toe into contact with the floor. A moment later, when, with wrist strength, he stopped swaying, he let go and stood and knelt and immediately crept to the side of the room, huddling in the deep shadow beside a bank of unlit terminals. He took the vibroblade from his mouth, positioning it so that its switch was beneath his thumb. He'd always been inconspicuous despite his size. Now he feared that, even with his best efforts and wishes, he wouldn't be inconspicuous enough. Now, again, where is the crystal? A voice floated out of the tunnel Tam had just left, a woman speaking with a Corellian drawl. Yes, we're going to pound the Vong pretty much. The mechanic snapped upright, turning to stare at the hole. His expression displayed no emotion, but his body language spoke eloquently of alarm, confusion. The voice continued. It doesn't matter how hard they hit us. We have 20,000 years of galactic civilization to draw on. They can't ever destroy that. The mechanic ran to stand beneath the hole, then leaped up. Tam charged forward, thumbing the vibroblade on. He could see the Bothan's expression, alarm and pain, through the rivulets of blood that flowed down his face. Tam slashed the man's bonds, 1, 2, 3, and they fell away from the Bothan. Run, Tam whispered. There was a crunching noise from the tunnel opening, hate-filled words in the Yuuzhan Vong language, then a scraping noise as the mechanic descended. And there it was, a moment of decision, an initiative to seize or abandon. With it was fear, more fear than Tam had ever felt, even when he had been a Yuuzhan Vong captive and certain that every moment would be his last. Tam turned and charged back toward the hole. As he lurched forward, he saw the mechanic's legs descending, heels toward him, toes toward the corner. The mechanic's feet hit the floor and he began to turn. Tam slammed into him with all his considerable mass, hammering him into the room's corner, stabbing wildly with the vibroblade, kneeing and screaming and battering. He felt blood on his knife hand, felt fingers around his left wrist. Then his wrist was being twisted mercilessly, as if by a machine, and he was face down on the chamber floor. There was pain like an explosion in his left arm, and when he twisted his head he could see that it was dislocated, the ball of his arm levered out of its socket. He hurt too much to move, almost too much to hear, but he caught the mechanic's words, "You fight like child." Then there was the sizzling noise of a blaster shot, a roar of such noises as a rifle on full auto fire opened up. Blood sprayed down onto Tam's back. The mechanic fell atop Tam. The mechanic's hand, vibroblade still held in it, hit the floor beside Tam's ear. Tam strained to look up. The door into the chamber was open, and uniformed security operatives were flooding in. With them was a brunette woman he'd seen around the base, Iella Wasiri, head of intelligence for this operation, General Antilles' wife. She knelt before him, and one of her men rolled the mechanic's body off. "Tam," she asked, "can you hear me?"
"I'm going to pass out now," he said,
and he did. Afran System, Afran 4. They came for Han and Leia in the quietest hour of the night, rushing into their bedchamber and leveling blasters before the two of them could stagger out of bed. Han stared into the bright lights affixed to the rifles. "What's the meaning of this?" he asked. His voice was calm, the words perfunctory. The leader of the intruders, only a silhouette behind the lights, answered, "Han Solo, Leia Organa Solo, you are charged with falsification of identification, smuggling, entering Afran space on false pretenses, and crimes against the state." "Is that all?" Han offered them a dismissive wave. "That's only a couple of hours' worth of crimes. Get up, get dressed." Han and Leia rose and began groping in the semi-darkness for their piratical garments. R2-D2 whistled, C-3PO, running through a self-diagnostic sequence in trickle-power mode, heard the alarm in his counterpart's musical tones, and started up full-power mode. In a fraction of a second, he regained use of his motivators and other systems. They were where they'd been when he'd performed his partial power-down, in the now-empty starboard cargo hold of the Millennium Falcon. "What's that you say? Performing a bypass of what?" The ominous clanking noise from the exterior cargo hatch just meters away made any answer unnecessary. Oh, dear, oh, dear. Surely there was some procedure in his memory for coping with an intrusion, but the only thing that occurred to the protocol droid was to run and hide. The astromech whistled again at him, clearly irritated with him for dithering. R2-D2 leaned forward into wheeled transport mode and rolled out of the bay into the circular corridor that provided access to most of the Falcon's compartments. C-3PO trotted along after his partner. "Could you slow down? This is an undignified pace." He followed the astromech into the stern compartment that provided access to the Falcon's escape pods. R2-D2 already stood at the portmost pod, his manipulator arm activating its access button. The door slid partway open and then jammed. The data screen on the front read, "Malfunction," but the astromech tapped on the button, a rhythm C-3PO did not recognize, and the door slid open the rest of the way. That noise was drowned up by the groan of the starboard cargo hatch opening, by shouts of, "Commence search!" and "Move all this out of here!" C-3PO trotted into the pod after R2-D2. "This is entirely inappropriate," he said. "Master Han and Mistress Leia are not doing anything illegal." The astromech whistled and tweedled at him as he activated the controls inside the pod. "Oh, they are? Well, yes, I suppose illegal is defined by local authorities, so there would be variations causing an accidental violation of local ordinances." Tweedle. "What, on purpose?" The escape pod hatch slid closed. In the hour before dawn, R2-D2 finally opened the pod door and glided out again. The Millennium Falcon was quiet, sheltered from weather by the bay walls. She did not even creak under pressure from wind gusts. "How very ominous," C-3PO said. Tweedle. "No, I will not be quiet." Tweedle. "Well, yes, for the sake of safety, I will lower my volume, but I will not cease speaking." C-3PO followed the astromech up into the cockpit. R2-D2's hemispherical head turned around, a complete sweep, as he evaluated the situation outside the cockpit viewports. There were no guards to be seen, but his musical trill alerted C-3PO to the holocams placed so that they could observe the port and starboard hatches and ramp the upper hatch. "Yes, R2, it appears that we are to remain here." The astromech trilled at him again, insistently. "Well, no, they would not have placed a holocam to monitor the secret hatch out of the false escape pod." Tweedle. "Are you mad? I can't go out there alone. I'll be captured and scavenged for parts." R2-D2's response was decidedly unmusical. It sounded like air being forced through a hut's blubbery lips. "There's no call for that. I recognize the danger Master Han and Mistress Leia face. I just have no wish to be terminated." Tweedle. "Yes, perhaps they face termination, too." C-3PO struggled with the notion the astromech had handed him. His duty was clear. Though he had no skills pertinent to this task, he did have to rescue Han and Leia. But rescue meant exposing himself to physical danger. This was something he'd done many times over the decades, usually under protest, dictated by his self-preservation programming. But now, that programming had become something more. It had become an actual dread. The notion that he could be assaulted so vigorously that his mental process might be suspended forever filled him with an eerie programming static that made it hard for him to move. On the other hand, the notion that Han and Leia might experience a similar amount of damage was even worse, and allowed him to regain use of his limbs.
"What do I have to do?"
Tweedle.
"Oh, no."
The concealed hatch in the Falcon's lower hull slid open. Shiny droid legs lowered through it, waving futilely as they sought the bay floor, meters below.
"Much farther, R2?"
The astromech whistled at him. C-3PO's torso, then head, emerged, as he was lowered at a steady rate through the hatch. He held on to a gray cord that looked more like a power cable than climbing gear. In fact, the knob under his hand was a data port plug. C-3PO looked around and then down at the Duracrete beneath him.
"Oh, I can't look. Please make it fast."
Moments later, his feet touched down. The cable continued lowering, piling up in irregular coils on the bay floor. R2 tweedled, impatient.
"Yes, yes, I'm going."
C-3PO walked with exaggerated care, like a sneak thief in a holocomedy, to the wall nearest the Falcon's stern. Then he turned and crept along the wall to the corner, turned again, and crept toward the bay doors, providing access to the street beyond. He kept his photoreceptors alert for other holocams, but saw none beyond those R2 had mentioned. He plugged the cable into the data port at the door. Now, in theory, R2-D2 would be able to work his magic on the computer handling access into and out of this bay. The astromech offered a musical trill, a noise of victory.
"Excellent, R2. And what? I have to what?"
"What we must know," said the man on the other side of the table, "is why you are here and what you are doing."
He was of average height, with a dark little beard, a dark little mustache. Dark little beady eyes, Han decided. The man wore the uniform of Afran's military security forces, but his accent was not of this world. He spoke basic with the tones of someone from one of the corporate sector worlds. "We're here testing the effectiveness of a series of spacer costumes being produced on Kaminor," Han said. "And what I must know is, how did you see through them? Our sponsors will want to know to make the costumes better next time."
"This is not funny," the man said.
"What's your name, pal?"
"I am Mudlath, Captain Mudlath of Afran Planetary Exosecurity."
"Well, that's funny. See, you don't lack a sense of humor."
Leia gave her husband the eye. What he was doing wasn't likely to make things much worse, but there was no way his taunts would make the situation better, either. They sat around a table in a Duracrete-lined room deep in the spaceport base. Han and Leia, their hands manacled behind their backs, their ankles bound together by cut-proof cords half a meter long, sat on one side of the table. Captain Mudlath sat opposite, with two of his men, unfriendly-looking ones, flanking the one door out of the chamber.
"I am pleased that you're comfortable enough in your current circumstances to remain jovial," Mudlath said. "Now, you should admit it. You are here engaged in some military action directed against the Yuuzhan Vong, knowing full well that any action you take could embroil the people of this peaceful world in your destructive war."
Han considered. "Isn't destructive war kind of redundant? Until I see a constructive war, or even a giggly war, I have to think so." Clearly exasperated, Mudlath turned his attention to Leia. "Surely you can ease your situation by being more cooperative than your husband."
"Well, he's angry," Leia explained. "And rightly so. We employed costumes precisely to save your people from any inconvenience. If the Yuuzhan Vong knew we were here, they might come. But if they didn't, they wouldn't. We were thinking of you, your needs and feelings, and you reward us with hostility. He should be angry."
"An interesting notion," Mudlath acknowledged. "But it still doesn't explain your mission here.
I need the names of everyone you've spoken with since your arrival.
Oh, dear.
Leah thought about it. Well, there was the officer who contacted us first, the one with the spaceport authority. I transmitted him our documents, and we got a homing beacon from him.
That's right.
Han nodded. He was friendly, unlike you, Captain. Then there was the baymaster who met us outside our bay. Rulicamp, wasn't it?
Elderly woman, Leah said. Not very talkative.
Then there was her aide, the one who liked my scar.
Sighing, Captain Mudlaff cupped his chin in his hand. Are you going to make me resort to sterner measures?
You mean torture?
Han perked up. Well, if you have to. But make it a good one. One I haven't seen before. I was tortured by Darth Vader.
So was I, Leia said. That was before we met.
You'll have to go some to top him.
Take them out of here. Mudlaff suddenly sounded weary. We'll get our answers later, and probably very unpleasantly.
C-3PO moved away from the bay where the Millennium Falcon was being held. It was the hour before dawn, so he was slightly less conspicuous than a gleaming golden droid would be during the daylight, but he felt as obvious as a 2-meter glow rod. A pack hung around his neck, filled and then lowered to him by R2-D2. It held items the astromech had thought he would need for his trip. He pulled out one of these now, a data pad, and opened it up. He keyed its audio input.
R2, do you read me?
The screen lit up. Yes.
Oh, I'm so relieved. So they are no longer jamming comlink frequencies?
They are still jamming within the bay, but you plugged me into the door computer directly, and I'm transmitting through that to a comm unit outside the jamming field.
I don't need the details. A simple yes or no would have sufficed.
Incorrect. The proper answer would have been no. They are still jamming comlink frequencies, and you would then have been mystified as to how I was communicating to you.
Your infernal devotion to minutiae is beginning to overload my logic circuits. Try a simple answer again. What do I do now?
Where are you? C-3PO looked around and read in information. He was at a corner of two space dock avenues, both now increasingly busy with pedestrian and land speeder traffic. He saw humans, non-humans, droids, self-motivated loaders, air speeders, cargo speeders, and avenue labels. They glowed atop posts.
I appear to be at the corner of row 14 and column 5.
Proceed to the southwest corner of row 25 and column 10.
How will I know which is the southwest corner?
If you manage to arrive there within the next 7 standard hours, east will be the direction where the sun is.
Very funny, ha ha.
Irritated to his cybernetic core, C-3PO set off toward the indicated destination. Han gave up on the door. He backed away to the cot attached to the wall and sat there.
I can't get the access panel off, he complained. It's built like a prison.
It is a prison, Leia said.
That explains it. Can you do anything with the Force?
Sure, if I had my lightsaber.
Leia stood at the center of the room, studying the air vents, the slot in the door that doubtless was intended for the insertion of a food plate, which, you'll recall, I left behind with your favorite blaster, since they are both sort of identifiable, but give me a minute. She closed her eyes and tried to submerge herself in the Force, to feel whatever it was that it might choose to show her. She could feel living things all around her, hundreds, thousands, too many to count, just as it was in any highly populated area. There were no pockets of dark side energy, no glowing beacons or other anomalies to focus on. There was the door, and though her telekinetic skills were far inferior to those of most Jedi she knew, she did possess some. She focused on the door, tried to understand its internal structure, as the Force showed it to her. She could feel its metallic strength, feel little discontinuities that suggested moving parts. Soon enough, she distinguished the vertical bars that rose and descended from the door to keep it from swinging open. Other bars, less formidable, slid in behind them to keep them from sliding into their unlocked position.
She plucked at the lower holding bar, felt it twitch under her effort. By concentrating further, she felt it slide free just for a moment, before some other energy pulled it back into place. Leah tried again with the upper bar. It, too, she could pry out of place for a moment, not long enough to slide the main locking bar out of position. She sighed and opened her eyes. "Not a chance," she said. "Not without a lot of practice. In maybe 2-3 days I might be able to handle one of the locks. In a few weeks, maybe I could do both at the same time and get that thing open." "It's all right," he told her. "We'll get out of here some other way."
"How?"
"I have no idea."